Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Hawk Blogger Mornings. I'm Brian Emhauser. You can find me all over the place at Hawk Blogger, YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, all of those places and more. And today it's a Thursday, and I got to admit, my mind is scattered because I've been working on this writing project for a while. And it has taken up all of my spare cycles to do the research, to do the interviews, to figure out where it was going to be published and how to publish it and how to tell the stories that were there. And there was so much that came out of what I did in preparation that there was no way it was going to fit even in the number of articles that I wrote. So if you don't know what I'm talking about, you haven't been to hawkblogger.com, I wrote an article and published it this morning about really the transition from Pete Carroll to John Schneider and what has been a pretty masterful performance by Schneider since that moment to take a Seahawks team that was struggling and going in the wrong direction and get it back to contention within 2 years. And so it is a mammoth set of stories that went into how the Seahawks got here. I could have tried to tell all of them, and I almost tried to tell all of them. Honestly, it's going to be worth doing a video series on this at one point, a documentary, hopefully. Hopefully the Seahawks make it worth doing all those things. But it's a pretty cool story. So if you haven't checked it out, please make sure you go to hawkblogger.com, read it. I think you'll enjoy it. It is a long read, but I think you'll enjoy it. I also, before I get into sharing some of the backstories and some of the stuff that maybe I couldn't provide context for in the article, I know that there's a lot of people that are dealing with flooding and all sorts of stuff in here in Seattle and maybe other places in the Northwest. We've been getting just torrential rain. I've got buddies that are stuck in their houses or, you know, have water, you know, overflowing from the rivers. So I really send my best. I know all of us do here that are watching the show and enjoying the show together. And hopefully things calm down here soon, but I know it's rough. It's rough. So take care of yourselves. Last little bit of note before I get into it. Tonight, 5 o'clock p.m. Pacific time, we have a fun Real Hawk Talk planned. We will have Evan Hill and Joe Fan will come together for the first time, and I can't remember how long. I don't even know if the two of them have ever just done a show with me before. So really looking forward to it. Last time we had Joe on, we had all sorts of technical problems. It was the one day that there was all this like AWS outages or whatever. But we will get him on, have some fun talking about Seahawks and Colts. So looking forward to seeing you guys tonight. All right. So the way I kind of started the article and the way I want to start the show is by, you know, sharing the actual, I wrote it in the article, but I want to play for you the actual audio of a moment in Pete Carroll's exit press conference, his final press conference, where he had said all these nice things about John Schneider. And like, it was a very emotional press conference. None of it was, well, I'll just play it for you. But he gets to a point where he explains, I think he was asked, are you excited to see what John can do, you know, in this role? And this is what Pete Carroll said. All right. So you're going to hear it. You're not going to see him. But this was the moment where the baton was handed.
It's why this happened. You want to know? Because I want him to have this chance. It's been 14 years. He's been sitting there waiting for his opportunity, and he deserves it. And he's great at what he does. And now he's going to find out. We'll find out, big fella. But
all right. He said this is why this happened. He said, you know, he's going to find out. You're going to find out, big fella. And he smiled at him and he pointed. This was not a shot at John, but it was a real moment of, you know, kind of be careful what you wish for. Like, you've wanted this, you deserve it. I don't think Pete held that against him at all, but it was this friendly warning of heavy is the head that wears the crown, so to speak. And there is no air cover anymore. There's no, like, everybody, for better or for worse, considered it a Pete Carroll team. He owned the final to say on football decisions. And so ultimately, Pete Carroll got the bulk of the credit and the bulk of the blame for what went on. And so John Schneider didn't have that air cover anymore. He was stepping into that role of being the head of football operations for the first time in his career at a time when the Seahawks were really going in the wrong direction. And I will show you guys some of the visuals that I included in the article. Let me put this up for you guys so you can see it as I go through it. Here we go. So this is the article up on hawkblogger.com. And this was a look, I'm going to zoom in a little bit here. This was a look at two specific numbers that were going on at the last 4 years of Pete Carroll's tenure here. And it is point differential, which you guys know well. And it went from plus 88 to negative 38 in those 4 years. Declined every single year. You also had DVOA for defense. It was a defensive-minded team. It was a defensive coach. All of those things. And this is the DVOA ranks for the defense over those 4 years. It went from 13th. In 2020 to 28th in 2023. So one of the worst defenses in the league. And John Schneider took over that kind of mess from Pete Carroll and did a bunch of things. And so actually I'll show you guys at least how the article's kind of laid out for when you get to it. But I basically wrote four vignettes on various parts of what Schneider did. And obviously the first thing that he did was hire Mike McDonald. And so I'm not going to go into the notes here, but I will just share this little visual of the people that were hired. Of the people that were hired from that 2024 head coaching class, this is what's gone on. Mike McDonald has tied Jim Harbaugh for the best record over those two seasons, last year and this year. They're the only two coaches that have an above 500 record in that time frame. And three of the eight have already been fired. I wouldn't be surprised if we add more to that list, depending on how things go with the Falcons, not this year, but it doesn't look like it's going the right direction. So what I did, just so you guys know, I'll back up a little bit and explain a little bit more. I talked to people throughout the Seahawks organization. I talked to John Middlecoff, who is a former scout, worked with the Eagles, and Howie Roseman, and has a lot of connections throughout the NFL. He also had interviewed John Schneider this offseason about some of the moves that he made. And then I talked to Michael Gervais, who is a performance psychologist who worked with the Seahawks from early in the Pete Carroll era up until about 2020 and still has some interaction with the team. In fact, one of the things that I'll kind of share a little bit more about is his... when John Schneider basically recommended him to Mike McDonald for help in kind of growing from year one to year two as a coach and kind of realizing the vision he had for a connected team. So The coach stuff, I mean, honestly, the other thing is you guys have been with me on this journey. So, you know, all the, you know, we've gone through, I've done a show about how lucky, how fortunate it was in some ways that things went the right way for John Schneider in terms of deciding to get Mike McDonald as his coach. It took a lot of things breaking the right way. And it included having teams like, you know, Atlanta and Carolina and, well, Washington didn't, but Atlanta, Carolina, Tennessee, all of those teams passing on Mike McDonald. They interviewed him before the Seahawks did. If you don't remember this, the Seahawks were a little late to get into the coaching carousel because I think Pete Carroll got his news a little bit later. And so that was one part of it. The other part of it was that John Schneider, well, I'll explain this in a second. So they got into it a little bit late. So they missed the window to do early interviews of Mike McDonald. And what that meant is they could not do any interview with Mike McDonald until he left the playoffs. But Carolina and Tennessee and Atlanta all did do the early interview. So they had the opportunity to make a call before the Seahawks did. They chose not to hire him. But John Schneider has connections in each of those organizations. Dan Morgan worked with him, worked for him before he became, you know, went to Buffalo and out of Carolina. Rich McKay is someone that John Schneider has a relationship with as well from Atlanta. Chad Brinker is a guy who runs, I think is the president of football operations for the Titans. He and John are connected. All of them told John Schneider that Mike McDonald was great in the interviews, but they all had other reasons. Like Tennessee at the time had just drafted Will Levis. They wanted someone who could develop a young quarterback. The Carolina Panthers had you know, were going to draft Bryce Young or either had or will, and they wanted a guy that was offensive minded. And then the Falcons went with somebody who was a more familiar face, someone that they knew, and they just felt comfortable going back to in Raheem Morris. And what I found in conversation with Nolan Teasley, who's the assistant general manager for the Seahawks, is that part of the reason that they missed that window is John Schneider wanted the most possible people in the organization to participate in the interview process. He wanted to be able to demonstrate to the candidate the full, like, horsepower is the word that he used, of the organization. And that meant there's an NFL mandated diversity training that you're required to take. And no, we're not going to get in a conversation about diversity training. Please just stay on task here. But it is a required process. And so that meant that all of these other people in the organization had to take that training. And the fact that it took a while for everyone to get through that also meant that they weren't able to do that early window. Why is that of note? To me, it's of note because it is really representative of who John Schneider is as a leader and how he goes about things. He doesn't want it to be just about him. He doesn't want it to be, you know, him in front. He wants to bring everybody along. He wants everyone to have a say, to actually provide some input. And he also wants, in this case, the candidates to get a feel for just how great the people are in the organization, because he's proud of the culture. And so that was a cool little insight from my perspective about what went on there. But it also turned out it could have been costly, right? It could have meant that they missed out on Mike. But then even after that, the fact that they were able to, you know, talk to McDonald, people forget that they stopped in Detroit first to talk to Ben Johnson. Ben Johnson was the hot name. And the Seahawks did talk to him. They got on a plane because they felt like they needed to talk to Mike McDonald. And Ben Johnson pulled himself out of any head coaching job at that point. And I don't know. There's people that will probably say, I wish, you know, Ben Johnson's doing great in Chicago. We would have been great with Ben Johnson. And maybe. Personally, I'm pretty happy with the way things ended up. The style of team that Mike McDonald and John Schneider are building together is exactly my favorite style of team. So I have no regrets on that. But also the fact is that when I talked to Mike McDonald for this story as well, and he reiterated again, John was just a huge reason why he took the job. I think people forget that a lot of people do not want to move out here. They do not want to move from East Coast to West Coast up to the Northwest at that, which is, you know, the weather, the tucked in the corner, all that kind of stuff. If you have no relationships, no family, like, it's a big thing to ask of somebody, and not everybody's open to it. A big reason Mike took the job was, one, he just hit it off with John Schneider. Like, they shared values, they shared communication, and everybody he knew just raved about John Schneider. There was a quote from Middlecoff. Let me pull open my notes here. And he, let me pull it up here. He says, there's probably not a guy that is more consistently highly thought of in the NFL with peers than John Schneider. People rave about how good he is in his job, and now it's like the proof's in the pudding. I mean, watch his team play. So that was Middlecoff on Schneider, and I think that's what McDonald heard. I mean, people raved about him. And so I think people just really, for whatever reason, they kind of like, yeah, they hired McDonald. That's a good move. That was an amazing move. Like, to go against convention, to get a defensive coach when everyone's hiring for offense, to go not get Dan Quinn, who you knew and had familiarity with. You know, there was some question about Mike McCarthy at some point. You know, there's other ways or options that they could have gone that would have been more familiar, more safe, would have been like aligned with what the rest of the league was doing, so you don't look like you're really taking a risk. John doesn't really seem to care about convention. I mean, this is the same guy that, you know, pounded the table for a short quarterback and worked with Pete Carroll on drafting tall cornerbacks. And, you know, he has gone against convention multiple times. I don't think that bothers him. And I think the Seahawks are very fortunate in that case, because a lot of people make these decisions out of fear and what's going to be safe. John just consistently does not do that. I think probably my favorite part of this series that I wrote, this collection of articles, was on the culture. And I'll start with just my general takeaway, which was a few things. John, born in Wisconsin, Midwest guy, had his parents immigrate. I think his parents immigrated, or his grandparents, but I think they're relatively new to the country. His dad made, became a really good orthopedic surgeon, orthopedic doctor, traveled around doing all sorts of medical work. His mom was, you know, kind of the taskmaster at home. And John talked a lot about how they instilled work ethic and faith were kind of the two things that they both really instilled. And that toughness was another thing that he kind of got from his mom. And he also was pretty vulnerable about the fact that, you know, he wasn't necessarily a great student in school. Like, he, academics did not come easy to him. And so he kind of turned to sports. And the more I dove in and talked to people and started to understand, like, one of the foundational aspects of who John is, I think, is that some things didn't come easy for him, and academics wasn't easy. And so he has now grown to be a leader who will say things like, nobody's smarter than anybody else. if you feel like you're smarter than anyone else, you and I are going to have a big problem working together. I think he grew up feeling like people thought they were smarter than him. And I also think his life experience was that working his ass off is what's got him where he is. So I think those things are really foundational in also his principles and his values and how he then went about picking who would be his coach. Who is Mike McDonald? Work ethic, he's super humble, does not think he's smarter, even though he is, does not think he's smarter than anyone else. And the two of them together have that in common. And then you bring that out, you span it out to the culture that they've built and who's in that locker room. Leonard Williams, Ernest Jones, Cooper Kupp, DeMarcus Lawrence. These guys are incredible workers. JSN, like put all these people out there, Sam Darnold, and they're all humble. Like it's a really different vibe for this locker room than it was for the LOB, which was much more bombastic and like in your face. It's not that they don't have dogs on this team, but they just show up a little differently. And initially, I kind of attributed that to Mike, but the more I've done research here, I really think it comes back to John, who sets the tone. Like this is part of the culture that he is instilling. And that's why he hired a coach that shared that. It's why the two of them are picking people that fit that. And honestly, it might have been part of why they were more willing to move on from some guys like Gino and DK, who maybe didn't fit that quite as perfectly. And so that was like one really strong theme that came out for me that was really, really kind of cool and meaningful. The other was that John has what's the right word for it? He has like a deft touch. He has a soft touch. And so when I was talking to Mike McDonald, and other folks and Michael Gervais and all these folks about how Mike McDonald got involved with Michael Gervais and Stephen Hauschka and the coaching thing. And really what John did is he put it in front of Mike McDonald. Like it was Mike's decision to make whether he wanted to use this. And what Mike really wanted to do is he wanted to he had this idea of a vision. He had just watched all the teams in the playoffs and believed that like toughness and connection were really key to being a great team. And so he really wanted to build on the connection and he knew he needed help figuring out how to do that. But he also wanted it to be a Mike McDonald like method. So he wanted it to be a schedule and something he could just like rely on and like go through the schedule each week and not have to think about it. And so what John did is he recommended that they have a conversation with Mike Gervais and Stephen Hauschka. That ended up turning into an ongoing coaching relationship for Coach McDonald, where they went through together and worked on, you know, his first principles and got it down, boiled it down to like a one pager of like what his vision was. And then also figured out how to turn it into tangible action. So every Thursday is kind of a culture day on the schedule. And that's where things like walk and talks came from. And if you don't know what a walk and talk is, this is this concept they had where first, before they even got to walk and talks, they did something where they all shared their why. You know, they were sharing like what made them the people that they are to kind of open up to the whole team. And that helped lead into these walk and talks because part of the vision for Mike McDonald was that the connection had to pierce the boundaries of offense and defense and special teams and wide receivers versus offensive linemen versus cornerbacks. Like he wanted it to be across the board. And so walk and talks were a collection of like five people, no more than five people. They would be given a topic and they still are, they still go on. And they would just take a walk along the water talking about the topic. And they didn't have to report back or there was nothing. It was just literally, here's a prompt. here's something to think about, go for a walk. And this is where things like Jaron Reed and Michael Dixon became buddies out of this, and kind of learn things about themselves. And you've got these just different guys that now have got connected. And part of what was really cool in hearing about where that all started, right, was this notion. There's this, let me get this quote right, because I think this was really, really key to bringing it home. So Michael Gervais said, yeah, part of the idea is that when you know each other, you're more likely to have each other's backs in a difficult moment, in a challenging moment. And that's what makes a great team full of great teammates. And immediately when he said that, I thought of the exact same thing that I'm sure a lot of you are thinking, which is when they had their biggest adversity, at least to date as a team, down there in LA, it wasn't a receiver. It wasn't Cooper Kupp that spoke up for Sam Darnold. It wasn't the coach did. It was a linebacker, right? Someone on the opposite side of the ball, somebody a totally different part of the team. And it was Ernest Jones saying, quite frankly, fuck you, to anybody who doubted his quarterback. And maybe that would have happened no matter what. Maybe that's just who Ernest is. But when I pull back the layers to this, I see the decision to bring in a quarterback who is humble and a hard worker who has earned respect in that locker room. I see a decision to bring in Ernest Jones. We'll talk about that in a second. And then re-sign Ernest Jones and make him a leader. I see the connection and the opportunity for them all to come together and develop the bond that's across this team that pretty much all of them talk about. And I think that's just as likely, if not more likely, to be why that moment happened. And we'll find out. Like, the Seahawks are 10-3 and haven't made the playoffs and haven't beaten the Rams. Like, there's a lot of things. This is not a victory parade. This is something cool's happened, and I wanted to capture it. Hopefully, you know, doing a decent job of doing that. So, I think, those two pieces were really interesting to me. And, you know, there's quotes in here from the players about how important this is. You guys just saw my Seahawks Saturday, where I went in with all the conversations just from last week about how much the players are talking about the biggest difference between this year and last year is the camaraderie, how this is the best defense they've ever played on because of the connection between the guys, like on and on and on. Connection, camaraderie, belief, you know, all those things showing up. There was one kind of final quote in the culture section that Michael Gervais offered just as an observation. As someone who's seen John Schneider since he was basically hired as, you know, a guy pretty much the same age as Mike McDonald when the first time as a GM. And he says, John's in a really cool phase right now. You can feel John's imprint across the organization. It really is like the hand that leaves the pond without a trace. And I thought that really captured John's leadership style well. What I got from Nolan Teasley and Matt Berry and other guys in the organization that have worked with John is he does everything in a group way. He just doesn't stand out. There was a really cool example of this, didn't make it into the article, but when they're working on scouting, John, first of all, he calls that studying, which is interesting. And one of the things that he makes certain to do is they've got interns in there and first or second year guys that they're trying to develop. And so this is what he said. This is what he said about how he intentionally is about showing up in those situations. He says, this is a very humbling industry. When we're all in there studying together, which again, I think is a cool way to put it, identifying talent, and we have an intern or a first or second year person that we are developing, and I say, look, I was at the school in October studying, watching this player, and I screwed it up. I don't have this right. That has this calming effect. They realize it's okay to challenge me. And so he's very intentional about, even to the lowest levels of his organization, making sure it's clear that he doesn't know everything and that people should bring up, if they see things differently, that he wants to hear it. And another piece that kind of speaks to this, and also just the way he's kept his feet on the ground, came from Middlecoff. This also didn't make the article, but he talked about that most of the GMs nowadays tend to be like corporate CEOs. Even the guys that came up in scouting, like John Schneider. But now they're in the office all the time, and they kind of get away from the roots of going to schools and scouting. And he's talked about that over the last two decades, he has gotten so many selfies from buddies, from scouting buddies, at a college football game with John Schneider. You know, whether he's watching Will Levis at Kentucky or he's at Oregon or somewhere else. And Middlecoff said, like, that's not normal. And the fact that no one's holding him to do that, he's choosing to do that, is, I think, a really cool reflection on kind of how John goes about it. Middlecoff also connected that directly to, you know, things that even didn't happen. This is Middlecoff's words. He said, I mean, let's face it, he would have traded Russell Wilson and taken Josh Allen if it was up to him. So that's the perception outside. That might be true. All indications are that Pete was the person who was very reluctant to move on from Russell. But I think there's a lot of respect around the league for the fact that John has not lost his fastball as a scout and a talent identifier. And that might be like his best attribute, because I think Mike McDonald is also an example of John identifying talent. And the other thing that John's talked about is it's not just players, it's not just coaches. It's the whole organization. And he said this. He said, so Ron Wolf and Ted Thompson, who John worked for before, they would also go out and do college scouting. And he said, so I was in the office with Coach Holmgren and all his coaches and the trainers and the doctors, and I was just naturally around. I didn't know any different. There are guys who are really good evaluators, you know, scouts, but come into the headquarters as a GM, and they have a hard time evaluating people. I thought that was a really fascinating insight in terms of how John takes a lot of pride, not just in knowing football players, but knowing every single person. This is part of why he's always bringing up Eric Kennedy, EK, and the guys in the cafeteria, and Connie Kate, and all the people that work in the organization that John takes the time to know and evaluate. So I thought that was really cool. I thought generally, like, the culture stuff to me was one of the more interesting pieces. And then you get into the quarterback decision. Obviously, I think we know this one pretty well, so I'm not going to go deep on all of this since we've already talked about it. But there was a pretty fascinating insight I found based off of some research. I'm going to talk to you about that in a second. Before I do, let's get to some super chats and also a couple other things here. Corey Hickok, who's been a member for 20 months, which is amazing, says, Brian, I just finished the article and wanted to give you your flowers. It's a fantastic piece of writing and makes me even more excited about the journey we are on this season. Man, thank you, Corey. I really, really do appreciate it. Har Jason has become a member. Well, welcome, dude. Happy to have you. Joseph Charles says, Rams lose to Lions and us gives us a one loss cushion. It does. I'm not counting on anything, guys. All I'm focused on for the Seahawks is the reality that they own their own destiny. If they don't lose, then they'll be just fine. So don't worry. I'm not worried about other people. Of course, I'll take it. But I think the Seahawks have enough to deal with themselves, and the goal should be getting to 14 wins. Win out. Run the table. Calvin says, I'm going to to the 49ers Hawk game, going to go to the 49ers Hawk game at the end of the year. I hope it's a meaningful game. You think there's a chance they rest the starters that game? Doubtful for either team. I think it's going to be a meaningful game. It's hard for me to see that game not having an impact on the seeding in the playoffs, but we'll find out. So yeah, I think that's going to be a hard fought game. And, you know, it'll be one of those things where, man, if they like win against the Colts and they beat the Rams and they beat the Panthers, and then you've got that game staring at you, it's going to be a little bit nerve wracking. No doubt about it. Thank you for the super chats. And probably a great time to remind folks that have not already taken advantage of the deal over at Sleeper. That's Sleeper. My gosh, my brain is toasted. SimplySeattle.com is what I meant to say. SimplySeattle.com, use code HawkBlogger15. Not only gets you 15% off, but 5% of your purchase price will go directly to the Fred Hutch Cancer Center's fund that helps people who are need transportation or other things to help when they're fighting for their lives. So you get 15% off. You get great Seahawks, Mariners, Huskies, Kraken, whatever it is, Seattle sports gear you love. 5% of whatever you spend will automatically go to a great charity. And if you buy a Simply Good hoodie, they're $25. They're great. They'll give away another $5 to charity. So it's a fantastic deal going on through December 24th. Make sure you take advantage of it. Go to jkboots.com/hawkblogger. Use that in your browser. It will get you your own special promo code, which you can use to get the best boots you're ever going to own. JK Boots, built, manufactured. They are handmade, I should say, in Spokane, Washington, by a family that has moved here and loves it. So make sure you go to jkboots.com/hawkblogger, get your deal. And then, yes, Sleeper. Head over to Sleeper, grab the Sleeper app if you haven't already. Get all your fantasy sports, all your NBA, hang out with your buddies. Great stuff there. And get $20 without making a deposit. Plus, if you use promo code Hawks, you will get up to $100 match on your first deposit. Terms and conditions apply. See Sleeper's terms of use for details. Currently operational over 25 states. Check out Sleeper today. Okay. I promised you we'd get back to the quarterback thing and this research I did, right? So I went on this deep, deep dive, and it occurred to me that John Schneider, I think, has done something really, really rare. And he did it twice. And that is move on from your quarterback. And it has to be a quarterback that has played at a Pro Bowl level. Then have him be valuable enough that another team wants to trade for that quarterback, so you get some compensation for the player. Have that player perceived to be so good that they're given a new contract before they even play a snap for the new team. And then replace that quarterback with someone who outperforms the previous quarterback and does it for cheaper. And add to that, have the guy that you traded away fall off a cliff and just play terrible football afterwards. That happened with Russell Wilson. It happened with Geno Smith. And I went through, it's not an easy thing to search for these examples. I went through, I talked to a bunch of people I know through the industry. I did my own research, dug through to try to find examples. I found a few examples of things that were close. But when, as far as things that actually met all of the criteria I just mentioned, there were four examples in history that I could find. And I'll put these up here so you guys can see. This is, Finn's getting excited. This is the example with obviously Russell Wilson and to Geno Smith on one. Here, let me let Finn out of here. One sec, guys. All right. So you see the Russell Wilson to Geno Smith move and then the Geno Smith to Sam Darnold move, right? And then the next two that kind of qualified was Donovan McNabb with the Eagles being traded to the Commanders, or at the Redskins at the time, and absolutely fallen off a cliff with the Commanders. Then Michael Vick stepped up, and he was fantastic in 2010, the year after trading away McNabb. The other example was Ken Stabler for the Raiders back in the 70s, who had been an all-pro player. They traded him away and elevated Jim Plunkett in his place. Stabler fell off. Plunkett led them to a Super Bowl. So there just aren't very many examples that meet all of those criteria. And John Schneider's done it half of those times. He's responsible for two of the four. That honestly all by itself was a wild insight to find. It's not easy to have any other general manager have such a failed evaluation, that you are so much farther along in your evaluation that someone else would give up draft compensation and extend the player and have that player fall off a cliff at the most important position in sports. And so one of the things Middlecoff said there was, he talked about how Bill Walsh would say that there's a really small percentage of people that have any clue what they're doing about when they're evaluating a quarterback. It's pretty clear by John Schneider's track record that he knows what he's doing at that spot. So that was an interesting insight there from, or an interesting quote from Middlecoff there. And even now, even with Sam Darnold being the source of a lot of consternation for Seahawks fans, the difference between him and Geno Smith is stark. It's a huge contrast, right? So that was the quarterback move, like home run, grand slam, it'll be a grand slam if they win in the playoffs and get further. And then I had some fun with this one, guys. You guys are going to know this one pretty well, but I think part of the story is, it's one thing if John Schneider just did one thing after the other that everyone agreed with, right? But this offseason, I called it the MacGyver or MacGruber offseason, right? You guys remember that. How many people hated what he did this offseason? Hated it, like panned it. And so I created this section. I had fun with this. This is the cover for this particular section called The Haters. And a little comic strip there. And then the thing that also really, I had this vision. Where did the haters go? There we go. I had this vision of taking some of the people that we have harassed on this show and creating like a bulletin board graphic. I'm so excited with how this turned out, to be honest. I'm very proud of it. And I took all these different folks, their hot takes in the off season that are cold takes now, and then their mea culpas. So you could see here, you've got Deontay Lee from The Ringer saying, I don't know how this team is going to be the worst in the NFC. I don't know how this team is not going to be the worst in the NFC West. Even if you're banking on the best outcome for Sam Darnold, I don't think there's enough for them to be a double-digit win team again. And then the apology is, last week, this was Deontay Lee in his power rankings that had the Seahawks number one overall in the NFL. He said, the top seed in the NFC is a real possibility for this team, which means the Lombardi Trophy is too. So, I mean, the contrast is crazy, right? Shil Kapadia on that same podcast, The Ringer, I think overall this is a worse team. I would be surprised if the team made the playoffs. This being one of the five worst offenses in the NFL is in play. his mea culpa. I was very skeptical of the Sam Darnold, Clint Kubiak relationship, but I'm taking the L, right? Like, I'm not going to read all these. You guys have seen these before. But the fact that, you know, John Schneider, this is where I feel like Pete Carroll's warning of, you know, you'll find out, big fella. This is it. You know, you traded away Geno Smith. You traded away your franchise quarterback. Well, you could define franchise quarterback. You traded away your starting quarterback who had been a two-time Pro Bowler with you. Also, the guy that Mike McDonald and Clint Kubiak had been publicly praising and wanting back. You traded away DK Metcalf. You did not sign an offensive lineman in free agency. You signed veterans like DeMarcus Lawrence and Cooper Kupp, Eric Saubert, people like that. You signed Sam Darnold as well, who people thought was clearly inferior. You did all of these things that all together, pretty much each individual move and collectively, people thought was unwise. And by the way, an underreported part of this is you bet on JSN being worthy of being a number one receiver. Everyone was like, this guy's a slot receiver and he can't play outside. What's that going to look like? Think about that. Think about all the things that everybody else was so friggin' wrong about. And John Schneider was so right about. That is not easy to do. It's not easy to do in three off seasons. It's really hard to do in one off season. And so, I mean, I think that kind of process where it ends up with Vegas putting the Seahawks at a 7.5 win over under. You had the Arizona Cardinals and the Miami Dolphins and the Minnesota Vikings that had higher over unders than the Seahawks did. So that to me was crazy. I won't go through the offensive line stuff because you guys have, you can read it. And it's a lot of it's from previous offensive line work that I've done. I did make a cool graphic I'll share with you. This was basically showing that this is the third youngest, second cheapest, and the most improved offensive line, at least by ESPN win rate, in the NFL. Pretty cool to do that after one offseason, right? The other thing that I think is underrated about his offseason is the deal, like re-signing Ernest Jones and Jaron Reed. I honestly forgot Jaron Reed was a free agent signing this offseason. But Ernest Jones was a huge, huge get. And they got him for 3 years, $28.5 million. Like a crazy, crazy deal for what is, I think, a Pro Bowl level linebacker. And then another small piece, and I could have gone deeper on this, but think about this again. Think about that John Schneider, the fact that a lot of GMs have egos with the moves that they make and they want to prove themselves right. Last offseason, they sign Jerome Baker and Tyrell Dodson. Mike McDonald comes in and he's pretty clear, pretty fast that those guys aren't going to be the fit. John Schneider could have tried to convince him otherwise. He deals them that offseason. They get Ernest Jones. If that move doesn't happen, if both of those moves don't happen, how many more, how much further away would we be from the Seahawks defense we're seeing now? That gained them at least a half a year of developing because they were able to see that, okay, Ernest Jones is a good fit here. Ernest Jones was able to see, yep, I want to be here. And they, as a collective defense, were able to start learning how to play together for the last half of last year. If that hadn't happened, if John Schneider had been too stubborn about the moves he had already made, the sunk cost fallacy, so to speak, they would have gone into this offseason looking for an inside linebacker. Ernest Jones wouldn't have known them from anyone. In fact, he hated the Seahawks. Remember, he said that when he got traded here. It was going to be an adjustment to be a Seahawk. The chance that he would be willing to go there, like openly, without having to be forced to go there via trade, I don't think are very good. And so you would have gone into this year very likely without Ernest Jones as your starting linebacker. And who knows who would have been. And even if you had done that, let's say you got someone good, you still would have had to get acclimated with them and the other players. So again, it's another example of how John does not get precious with his moves and is willing to move on and is just constantly looking for how to make the team better. The Rashid Shaheed trade this year, that figures as well. I talked to the guys in the organization. They were having conversations about that trade before they played the Saints in week, what was that, 3? So like this was something they had been thinking about and working on for a while and then executed it. And I think we've already seen him really help with one game. You could say he was, if not the biggest reason, one of the biggest reasons they won this last game and really turned things around in the second half. But I think he's going to do a lot more than that. And then the draft, which I don't think I have to sell you guys on the draft. I mean, Gray Zabel, Nicky Minwori, they've at least been mentioned as offensive and defensive rookies of the year. Doesn't mean they're both going to win or either is going to win, but that's the level of player that they drafted with their first two picks. Elijah Arroyo, Torrey Horton, Jalen Milroe, Bryce Cabledew, Robbie Oots, Mason Richmond, they all make the 53. And then you got Ricky White on the practice squad, Riley Mills, who is practicing to hopefully come back. We'll find out if that happens this week. But it's a stellar draft. And that doesn't include the undrafted free agents who we'll see more of another time, but like Jared Ivey and Connor O'Toole and Chris Paul Jr. now that they got from the Rams. Like there's a lot of rookie talent that they got this year that I think is going to serve them well for years to come. So there's obviously a ton. I mean, I really enjoyed kind of pulling this all together. I also was super stressed out about it, to be honest. I was having conversations with different publications about maybe publishing it in a larger, you know, off my site, somewhere more established, I guess. And for a lot of reasons, decided that wasn't the right way to go. Whenever you're trying to tell someone else's story and honor like what actually happened, it gets a little bit more stressful than just straight analysis. And also the amount of time that people gave to me for this piece was very generous, and trying to make sure that I honored their contributions and their time without just making this literally a book, which it could easily be. It was a little stressful, but I'm proud of the result. I'm proud of the fact. I also like worked on the graphics. I worked on this widget, which may or may not be something that people get annoyed with, but that whole collapsible section is something that I built to help give it a feel of where it's not just one massively scrolling article, but you can kind of dive into different sections of the rebuild and what John Schneider did. So I'm proud of it. I hope you guys like it. I'd appreciate any feedback on it. And more important than anything else, let's share it, because here's the thing. If John Schneider does not win Executive of the Year, then they should just retire the award. I mean, the fact that this guy has not won it already is a joke. The fact that they gave it to the Colts GM in, what was it, 2012, because he drafted Andrew Luck number one overall, which everyone else in the world would have done and took no talent whatsoever. When John Schneider drafted Russell Wilson in the third round and Bobby Wagner in the second round of that same draft, I mean, ridiculous. It was ridiculous. And I'd like to right that wrong. I'd like to see John Schneider win Executive of the Year because he deserves it. I don't think anybody did anything close to as impressive or as difficult as what John Schneider did this past offseason. We joked about the MacGyver versus MacGruber. Like, he could have either saved the day or blown us all up. And as of now, he looks like MacGyver. Like, he looks like the hero. And he used every resource at his fingertips to make it possible. And I hope things, for a lot of reasons, continue to go well. I also hope that people appreciate the amount of time and the way that he's chosen to go about it. Because he is someone that tends to be a little bit from behind, quieter, And I don't know that he always expresses himself that well in interviews. So, you know, I hope he gets his flowers. I really do. Let me just check to see if there are other super chats. There's this one here from the North Bend House. My kingdom for a few Darnold called runs to get the D on its heels to help Darnold get in the end zone. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a decision-making process for Sam. So we'll, you know, he's still got to figure that part out. We'll be talking to Sam Darnold here in a few hours at the VMAC and see what happens there. I can give you updates on practice from yesterday, at least from in terms of who was there and what's going on with the Colts. Let me take a few minutes to do that. So we had Jalen Sundell and Eric Saubert back on the practice field as expected. They were both limited. We'll see what happens today. I think that's a key moment in the week. Riley Mills was a full participant for the first time. This is, I think, the last week where they can have him practice before they have to make a decision about whether to activate him on the roster. Mike McDonald's been a little bit hesitant at this notion that they're just going to redshirt him. Like, he's like, no, he's able to come back. So I think a lot of folks are skeptical that he's going to, but they might create a spot for him. We'll find out. Julian Love and Jaron Reed, who both played last week for the first time in a while, they were both limited. I'm just assuming personally that it's just them being careful with those guys, but we'll find out. From the Colts perspective, I thought there was some pretty meaningful news there. DeForest Buckner practiced for the first time in weeks as limited, but Sauce Gardner and Braden Smith, the right tackle, did not practice. I think we might be headed for a situation where Braden Smith does not practice. Also, Charvarius Ward, the cornerback's already on IR with a concussion. The DeForest Buckner one is one to really watch. I mean, he can change a game and certainly would change things for that team. But that's kind of where things stand. I believe Phillip Rivers is going to start this game. I told you in first look yesterday, you know, why I would start him and why I think there's reasons to be wary of him. We'll talk more about it tonight at 5 o'clock with Joe Fan and Evan Hill. And I think I'm going to get Tale of the Tape out at some point, but I got to admit, like, I've been writing for days and need a little bit of a break, but I will get Tale of the Tape out at some point this week. You guys saw the data at least yesterday on first look. All right. Let me make sure I did not get any other super chats on Venmo, which is really, really nice. I appreciate the people have been trying to do Venmo super chats. I appreciate all super chats. Let me make that very clear. But the Venmo super chats go 100% to me, whereas the ones on YouTube, 30% goes to Google. So some people have been trying to make sure I get all of it. Okay. So here's one. Oh, a couple ones just from today. This is cool. Joey Hamilton says, just read your blog piece. Why is this doing that? Come on. Just read your blog piece on Schneider. What a great article. Would love to see you interview Michael Gervais this offseason to get behind the scenes look at the culture building. Yeah, I'll see what I can do with Michael on that front. Carrie Lee also says, great article from one Seahawks sicko to another. Thank you. Thank you for your daily coverage. How many of our 8 IR returns do we have left? Oh, Carrie, that's a good question. Here is who has come off IR for the Seahawks. Let me pull it up real quick. We know Robbie Oots. We know Julian Love. We know Jaron Reed. So who else? So that's 3. I'm looking right now to get a full look. Yeah, so that's 3 that I can find really quickly. The Seahawks still have Derek Young, Jalen Sundell, Eric Saubert, Torrey Horton. That's 4 more. That would get you to 7. See if there's anybody else. Yeah, those are the ones that are most likely to come back. So those are the ones that I'd keep an eye on. But yes, they are getting close. They do get two more when you get to the playoffs, if there's need to be. So just so you know, you get 10 total when you go to the playoffs. All right, folks, I'm going to call it there. This is fun. Hopefully this is helpful. I mean, I, admittedly, when I pressed publish, one of the first things I wanted to do is come out here and talk to you guys about it, because it was kind of what's the phrase? I'm spacing on it. I can't even think of phrases anymore, but it was a lot of work, and wanted to kind of share. I wish I could share every conversation I had with all these different folks. I think you guys would find them fascinating, but hopefully the article gives you a good insight, and hopefully this show has given you a little bit more than that. All right. Appreciate all of you for tuning in. Have a great rest of your Thursday. I will see you for Real Hawk Talk tonight at 5 with Joe Fan and Evan Hill. Until then, take care.